Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee with our head coach, Chad Timmerman.
Hey, everybody.
Our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hello.
And Nate just finished scarfing down some macaroni because he's carb loading for a race that we're prepping for.
I am.
Yes, he is.
Chad's shaking his head.
we're actually here because we're prepping for a race called the Carson City Off-Road. We've pre-rode the course. We've got some game plans in place, and we're hoping that from our experience there, we can share some principles that you guys can apply to whatever race you're doing next.
You know what we should talk about first that doesn't add any value?
Sure.
Jonathan met someone at Whole Foods.
Oh, yeah, I did. Yeah.
Yesterday.
I was getting a salad, and Mr. Lance Armstrong was at Whole Foods, so... Yeah.
It's just right next to you.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Yeah. So I shook his hand and talked to him for a bit. And hopefully I get to race him tomorrow. That would be fun. I think so. I think he is racing.
I want you to beat him. That would be cool.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Mm-hmm. Me too. He's here for the Carson City Off-Road, like practically everybody else in the mountain bike world right now. Really big race. And it's one that we've got, would you guys rank this as a B race? A race? I'm not really sure for you guys.
It's B for me. I took 3 days off in a row, and just because I had weird travel stuff and no sleep, mm-hmm. and we did a big pre-ride of the course that I was already tired for. It was supposed to be an easy ride for me, and then John's like, we got a national pro.
national champ.
National champ Jason coming McKelvin. With us and these other people, and you guys hung out with each other, and I tried to keep up.
Yeah, and I was somewhere in the middle.
So for you, Chad, is this a B?
Pretty much everything is B up until cross season, so this is just kind of a loosely structured, have fun sort of affair.
Even single track six? You're not going to do a bigger taper for that?
I don't think I'll taper for it. No, I'll probably train up to and through it.
Nice. I like it. So a single track six is my A race. I've actually seen a few people commenting and you know, looking forward to us breaking down my nationals prep or anything else like that. And for those that didn't hear on the podcast, I'm not doing nationals this year anymore. Instead, I'm just focusing on single track six.
Which is a 6-day mountain bike stage race.
It is in British Columbia. Kootenays? It's going to be awesome. Kootenays? In the Kootenays. Yeah. So that's my A race. This race is really not like that race. Sure, it's on a mountain bike, but this is a 50-mile mountain bike race that I'm doing. You two are doing the 35-mile version. Everybody listening can take what they can from that. We'll just leave it there.
No, I want to say something. In our culture now, it's like if you run a 5K, you're somewhat less... You're less of a person than the 10K, than the half marathon, the marathon. Mm-hmm. It used to be... You did a 5K, you do it in 16 minutes, oh my gosh, you're amazing. It didn't matter the distance, it just mattered if you're specializing in. Chad and I, 50-miler, doesn't sound like very much fun, does it?
Does not.
Yeah, the 35, pretty fun,
yep.
Right, and challenging.
Yeah, we learned this lesson with Lost and Found.
Yeah.
I didn't think the 100-mile was going to sound fun. I thought or would be fun at some point. And 60-miler, I figured there's a good chance we'll enjoy that whole thing. And I did. I fully did.
You don't always have to just make everything more epic and more epic and more epic until you do like Ram across Truth. America, right?
I must point out, I think I was pressured in by you, Nate, to do the 50-miler. So we should
probably
get that one out. Yeah. So let's get that out of here. And the reason that I'm saying that is because the racing that we'll be doing for my A race, it is not 50 miles. It's going to be somewhere around 20 to 25 miles a day. And it's just going to be 6 days in a row of that. So 50 miles isn't directly applying to this, but I'm still considering this a B race.
Can you do the 35?
I probably could, but I just want to stick with the 50. I want to do something hard. So here's an example of kind of what we talked about before.
That was a dig, Chad.
Here's something that I want to touch on that we talked about on a couple episodes ago, but there's something to be gained. I think that this is going to be really challenging for me physically and mentally to stay focused and go through because it's a tough course. So I'm looking to glean a lot mentally and kind of psychologically from this, just that I'm tough enough to stick things out. So that's really the main benefit I'm looking for from this race, but it is a B race for me. So we're going to go over a lot of different things, but first, I know that those that are listening to this probably aren't doing this course. But we're just going to break this down so you have some context. Once again, it's a 50-mile course for me. Usually they're a big lap, just one big lap. But this year, it's you're just going to be doing multiple laps on a set course. So for those that are doing the 35-miler, so for you two, you'll be doing a short lap, they call it, which is actually just 4 minutes or four miles shorter than the other one. So you're going to do, or forgive me, it's just like 3 miles shorter, forgive me. 16 miles is your first lap, And then your second lap is going to be 18 miles. And then the only difference for almost me 19. Is I do, yeah, almost 19. The only difference for me is I do that lap again. So I'll be doing the short lap, then two long laps. You'll be doing the short lap and one long lap. Let's get our goals out of the way in terms of time. And then we can kind of go back to these. Chad, you first.
Optimistically, I'd like to go under 4 hours. More realistically, I think I'll probably be somewhere between 4 hours and 4.5.
And this is, and just to give people context once again, sorry, that the laps, it's about 2,500 feet just under per lap on the longer lap. So it is a good amount of climbing that we're getting in here. So it's not just like
a and that lap. Short lap's no slouch, just a little over 2,000.
Yeah, yeah.
Nate. Okay, so Nate's goals. And they wrote down on the spreadsheet my goals because they just, and of course, you guys picked them.
With a question mark.
And of course, you picked a time slower than Chad. Thanks, guys.
we pre-rode. I mean, we have the benefit of insight.
It's true. We'll get into this later.
That's another dig.
It's not. It's observation. It's that's all.
A fact can still be a dig.
It wasn't true.
And then you guys put time goals. My first goal. Don't crash. Don't break any bones.
That's a good point.
Right? Second goal, don't do some bonking thing so Chad can say, you ate too much sugar. that's the next one. Yeah. And then after that, I actually have no clue on the time because when we pre-rode, I was, I did it at like 190 normalized power. So we can't use that time as it. And during the downhills, I was behind one of our engineers for probably half the downhill that I couldn't keep, that slowed me down. So, and I also had a backpack on that we'll talk about more that weighed an extra 10 pounds.
Yeah.
So I've changed my setup a little bit. So I don't know what my time will be. If you see a DNF, hopefully it's from a flat.
Yikes. Yeah. Hopefully that's not the case regardless. I'm going for on the 50 miler, I'm going for a 4:30. That would be the ideal goal. If I can get to a 4:30, that would be awesome. That'd be a good time, I think. But my expectation in terms of, a normal finish would be somewhere in between 4 hours and 45 minutes and 5:15. But really the main expectation is to beat you to the finish line, Nate.
And that's because I would start 45 minutes later.
You do.
And your downhills, you put like an hour on me on the downhill. So literally an hour.
Not a joke.
Yeah. It's a long descent too, that we have. There's a lot of time descending, I guess is the point. It's not just a bunch of uninterrupted stuff. It's a big long descent. So that certainly will allow me to do that. So let's get into first. So we pre-rode this course and you don't have the luxury of pre-riding a course every time, but in Ironman racing, Nate,
you can usually, and people do, they will either fly at a different time of the year or like race week, they'll do part of the course. Mm-hmm. There's only a couple times I can think where part of the course was closed because usually on just like major roads.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah. Okay. Like I think Ironman Boulder goes on like a bunch of bike paths and stuff like that. And I've heard they have some traffic issues. So I could see that. But in most cases, you can probably go out and pre-ride the course. And we kind of came up with a few things as far as I think it's pretty clear why you'd want to pre-ride a course, but especially if it has any tricky sections. And in this case, we had like the first 3.5 miles of single track. That was really tricky. And what would you, if you guys went into that without pre-riding on race day, that would have sucked. Right.
I almost wish I would have gone in without looking at it. Because
I'm of the same opinion.
Really?
I almost think we did more damage by knowing what's ahead of us because that was pretty tricky stuff.
Yep. I know now and I'm like, it's on the second lap, there's a tricky section. And when we pre-wrote it, there was like you, a national champ, another really good guy, and then another guy, one of my friend who's better skills than me. And each one of you would dab your foot on a section.
Because of me,
And I wouldn't even try, right? And now,
a lot
of it too, like, I know that's coming up, and maybe I do have a benefit of I should just do like a cyclocross race and jump off and run over that part, because if Jonathan can't make it through, I don't think I'll make it through. The other thing that we didn't do, which we should have done for mountain biking, is the hard sections, we should have sessioned them.
Yes.
It was just, we were all just concerned about getting in the miles and riding the course.
To be fair, we were running out of daylight. We didn't have a whole lot of time.
We could have cut it short or done something. I don't know. But we could have just, the tricky part, ran that five times, went back the same way, And John could have been like, everything else, everyone can handle. It's just fine. And we would be faster on race day for it.
I can
guarantee.
That was what I was going to point out, was mistake number one with our pre-ride is that there was no sessioning. I sessioned one section that was tough for me, and I ended up finding a better line.
But you did it all of twice. I mean, I'd like to go out there and do it four, five, six times.
And that's the thing I want to get to, is this is a very individual process. Even if you go out with people, hopefully the people that you're with, make it clear that pre-riding is not about riding the whole loop. Pre-riding is not about finishing it in a certain time or hitting a KJ number or a normalized power number. Pre-riding is about inspecting.
Yeah.
And that's what you should do. And in this case, for me, in those sections, it wasn't pushing me to the point where I really wanted to redo, right? But for you guys, and especially you, Nate, it was well out of your comfort zone.
Well, me too. I was on a brand new bike. That's literally the first ride, and I figured out some things, some fit issues that made that even trickier.
But even if it was not a new bike, it was still hard, right, Chad?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There's no bike that would make that easy.
It's tricky. Yeah.
But in this section too, Jonathan knew the rest of the course really, really well. Mm-hmm. So what we should have done is, thinking back, is when we scheduled this, we're going to do 2 hours on this hard section. Mm-hmm. And then go back, and that's it. So everyone get together, go on your own pace. Maybe we can work on some, even Jonathan, who it's not as hard, he could help us pick lines through the better sections.
Right. Yep.
That would have been such a better use
beneficial.
Of time.
Yep.
Yeah, such a better use.
A couple things that I do think we did well. We planned this the week of, but not right before. Which that's always tough if you're traveling to a race. But if you're doing it just right before the race, like the night before, anything like that, make sure that you are really putting a lot of importance on not doing the whole thing or putting a lot of stress on your body. Just figuring out those tricky parts.
We did it on a Tuesday and the race was on a Saturday.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was pretty good. So another thing that I feel like we did pretty well, so we had, at least I had my devices all set up to record this, because that's another important thing. You want to have data usually afterward to be able to figure things out. Technical stuff on a mountain bike, obviously you're not going to have a lot of data to point that out, but outside of that, you want to know where it falls on the course, everything else, and if you have data, that's a good idea.
Yeah, so like how many miles in to the first aid station or something like that?
Exactly, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or another good thing is, we were talking about this, how long until the first aid station? So at our slow pace, it was about an hour to the first aid station.
Yep.
So now I know on a race day, maybe it's going to be 45, 50
And we also know the exposure. So how long we're going to be sitting in the sun, going up a hill, you know, how much we're going to sweat. It's not like we're descending to that first aid station. We're doing plenty of work getting there.
Yeah.
And how steep it is, which is, it's hard. I'm glad we have Eagle.
Yeah, it's for you guys, that's going to be great.
And the whole range of that.
Dig. Yeah. For you guys.
Oh, no, I don't have Eagle. Yeah, so that's, forgive me, that was the intent. Very sensitive today, Nate. Lots of digs coming your way. So one other thing to cover with this, if you're doing a short race, so if you're doing like a sprint try, or if you're going to ride a criterium, or if you are doing a mountain bike race that doesn't have really long laps, you can also come in with a slightly different goal for pre-riding. And if you have enough time before the event, you can also do something slightly different. And what I'm getting at here is you can have a game plan coming into the race, and then you can test portions of, if not all of that game plan within reason. You obviously don't want to put too much stress on your body, but if it's a short lap, something else like that, not only is hitting turns or obstacles at race pace beneficial because you understand how it's going to actually, you know, in the interplay there come race day, but also, let's say that you have this plan that you're at a criterium course and there's a climb every lap that you hit, and you want to know how your body reacts to that if you're actually going at race pace. That's something else. You can kind of test that pacing plan. So that's another element of pre-riding, not just going out to scout the technical lines, but if you have enough time and it's not going to put enough or too much stress on you, you can also test the pacing or strategy.
I hear so many times too where I'll be at a race and somebody who's done it before, they're like, oh, at the bottom of that turn, you don't need your brakes. You can go right through that.
Yep.
Where when you see it, you're like, oh, shoot, I need to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think there's like different levels of the benefit of pre-riding, where mountain biking technical is the most beneficial.
Totally.
If you do it. And then the least actually, and triathletes probably do it a lot, but a triathlon course, because usually they're not technical, they're straight. All you have to do is have gears.
Yep.
And you just follow your power the whole time.
Yeah, I wouldn't even bother. I'd just drive it.
We saw that all the time at when we were in Kona. A lot of people, even the day before, just like pretty far out on the Queen K. Now, granted, we don't know if they parked somewhere and then we're just riding a section, but it is really strange in a scenario like that to go out and just ride a portion of that course. Because also, like, the only thing that's technical in that sense is maybe the wind hitting you. And in that case, it's not going to be the same. So
I'm hoping those people weren't racing and they were just there and they're like, I want to get a big workout in today because tomorrow it's all going to be closed off to me.
I'm hoping that was the case too.
Because it was like a 50 mile, looked like people were doing 50 miles
crazy.
The day before an Ironman.
But a lot of people do that, make that crucial mistake of training right up to the day before their event, thinking that, that somehow they're going to maybe build some last minute fitness or they need to stay sharp and this is going to help them do it. But either way, it's big mistake.
That's a good point. Yeah, very good point, Chad. So I guess that kind of more or less covers the actual pre-riding part. But as far as equipment, let's cover that. We've talked so many times about you show up on race day and your aero helmet, your TT helmet makes, you know, it pushes into your back and you never realize because you didn't actually use it. Or equipment issues if there's problems beforehand.
Yeah, we did a full dress rehearsal for this one.
Yeah.
And then we changed stuff.
Yeah.
And so we're going to do brand new stuff on race day.
Yeah.
Some of it, nothing too crucial. I mean, I chopped my bars down a bit, adjusted my saddle.
Yeah.
One thing crucial, water carrying. So let's talk about that first.
That
because
kind of
this race, we're going to be in the sun, long endurance event. Chad and I pre-rode with Camelbacks or some type brand of Camelback. And I weighed how much water that I was going to be carrying with my backpack and the tools in there. Let's take out the tools. And I believe... 3 liters of water, which I was like, I won't have to stop at aid stations, is 6.2 pounds. Does that sound right? 6.6 pounds, 6.6, somewhere around there. It's
pretty
over six
hefty.
Pounds. With the bag, I think it was going to be 10 pounds total.
That's hefty.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Totally slowing it down. So instead of that, and because we know where the aid stations are, I'm doing just one bottle. But on our Yetis, our 4.5Cs, Chad and I have the same bike, you can only mount it below the down tube. So it's a far reach.
It's not the easiest grab.
Exactly. And we're going to have pictures of this.
Yep. Yeah. It'll be all up on Instagram. You'll be able to see exactly what we're taking with us, all three of us. You'll be able to swipe through from left to right and you'll be able to see which one.
Like mine more. I'm Nate. It's all a competition, everything we do.
So something really quick on that though, and I know this is more contextual, but on the mountain bike side of things, if you do have a situation where you have to put a bottle cage underneath, I really recommend having a side-loading bottle cage because that makes it a lot easier for you to get the bottle in and out because otherwise what you end up doing is having to kind of awkwardly pull forward
underneath
your frame. Pull the bottle
toward your front wheel.
Yeah, and a lot of the time it'll finally pop loose, hit that front tire, and fly out of your hand.
So Jonathan told me that, and then I went and tried Roto in the parking lot, and I could not get it in.
On the side-loading?
Yep. It didn't click in, and I would look down, and it would be kind of halfway in. I'm like, oh, I'm losing that bottle. So I'd switch to the Specialized rib cage. And I do notice you have to push down and forward, but I have so much room, I'm not going to hit my front tire.
Because you have a very large
knock
frame.
On wood. Yeah, exactly.
You have an extra large.
But I like the click in, and it feels like it holds it really strong. So
which Chad has a brand new bottle cage. It'll be a really positive
I played
click
with it
in.
Yesterday. Did it about 10, 15 times. So I feel confident it's not going to be an issue.
Yeah, so that's a contextual tip.
So no backpacks for us, just one bottle.
No, so we take that weight off our bodies. Maybe a little bit of cooling going on there too. I mean, if you have a bunch of ice in your Camelback, that can help out. But
they usually are insulated between that bag.
And that's what I found because I stuffed that thing full of ice and it was vaguely cool, but it wasn't helping out.
Definitely cooling. Small aerodynamic benefit, obviously, but I don't care about that.
Right.
Because you take that Camelback off and your body is just covered in sweat.
Yeah. Right? You're going to be venting so much heat out
and
of
our,
back there.
Our anticipated temperature, I mean, the day's high is like, I think, 95 or something. It's up there.
It lowered to like 92.
Okay.
So
I'm looking
at the weather right now of what we should expect. And at my race, when I start, it'll be 66 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's nice.
Pretty nice. That's really cool. And then by the time, if I adhere to my plan, I should be finishing right around where it gets to 80 to 85 degrees. Mm-hmm. And you guys honestly should, if all things you should be finishing around then too. So 80 to 85 degrees, I know that probably doesn't sound too hot and it really isn't too hot in the grand scheme of things, but something that Chad briefly mentioned before, there is no shade on this course. There's some, you get into spots every once in a while with trees, but they're pretty sparse. And also the angle of the sun, it just means it's going to be hitting us directly.
So I'm carrying like the large size, what are they, 24?
24 ounce.
Yeah, I have a 24 ounce bottle and I'm going to start the race full of ice and then just refill it at an aid station. And at that aid station, I'm going to also probably chug another half bottle.
Yeah, that's the key. We all kind of talked about this. We're like, you know what? Aid stations are spread throughout. We can keep water there. Also, something to keep in mind, if you carry a lot of water with you, that water can get hot. Mm-hmm. And sometimes sipping hot water.
Nothing more dissatisfying than a hot mouthful of water.
It's frustrating.
It actually doesn't absorb into your gut as fast as cold water.
Yep. So if you are getting at these aid stations, which we have yet to find out, we'll find out today if they're actually going to be handing up bottles, which I think they will, because last year I remember some friends bringing down giant coolers of bottles that people discarded to grab another one. So I think they're going to have bottle service, not that type, but bottle service for us on the course.
But see, this is a little more important for Jonathan because he's actually going to be racing this. And it's not to imply that Nate and I won't be racing. I mean, we'll still be going for it. But if we know, you know, I'm shooting for a 4-hour time, if I stop at each aid station, so a total of 3 stops, and those stops take me 1 minute to fill a bottle and grab an extra drink, I mean, 3 minutes over a 4-hour race probably isn't going to be pivotal.
How much did you beat me by last race? Minute 50.
Yeah.
With, and I had like
daggers
4 minutes
right there.
With no issues.
He just threw some daggers his way. Yeah.
Well, but anyways,
forget the 15 minutes of downtime.
What I will do in that situation, if there are bottles, is I will chuck my bottle, grab one bottle, put it in my cage as quickly as possible, or put it in my mouth hanging there, grab another bottle, put that one in the cage, drink some, and then throw some, because I do require more water than,
than you're bigger.
Like Chad.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I am bigger.
One thing that I do, if this possibility presents itself, if they have bottles and you can grab one in the beginning and you can grab one at the end, if it's a longer feed stage or feed zone, what I'll do is I'll grab one bottle and I'll put it either in my mouth, like you mentioned, or into the bottle cage. And the next bottle I grab, and I use that specifically just for cooling.
Douse yourself. Yep.
I spray it on one key thing.
It's water.
Yeah. Make sure it's water. If not, you're going to get mix all through your hair and it'll be gross. But when I put water onto my head, I try not to put it onto my face because it gets on your glasses and then you have vision issues.
Sunscreen in your eyes.
So what I do is I usually put it on the back of my head, let it run down, and then I usually squirt it on my lower back. That seems to really help. And then if I can, I try to hit my arms and legs, my thighs. And those two things, if I can do that, I've noticed huge benefits right after. Even if it's just psychological, I feel fresher, I feel better. So that benefit is very much there.
I just spray it on the back of my neck, let it run down, soak the jersey. Mm-hmm. It's amazingly refreshing.
The worst part, I've been in a race like this, an aero helmet, where you try to get it into your helmet, but there's not enough slots.
Just don't.
Yeah. No, but I did it in Las Vegas for a race, and I was overheating, and I tried to get water in, and you just couldn't. And you get in like this panic mode, like, I'm overheating.
That'd be terrible.
Triathletes, what they do is they put ice down their pants.
Yeah.
And there's some kind of science like that area cooling it, like helps cool your whole body.
Yeah, because that's a huge area for venting a lot of heat. Your body vents a lot of heat through there. So
yeah,
that makes sense. We're all going to be using, or I'm going to be using Scratch Labs.
I'm using Scratch Labs this time. I actually used it last minute, changed it on race day, but I got an iron stomach.
I liked it. I'm going to find out today what they're using at the feed stations, because hopefully they use Scratch.
Yeah, I think they're a sponsor.
Yep, nice. I think they are. I should just pick my events based on if they use Scratch or not. That's how I'm going to prioritize my events, because otherwise I just can't have it.
And they pay, we have no affiliation with Scratch.
Zero.
But we pay retail.
Yeah, it's just the only thing that doesn't mess up my stomach and take my race day and throw it away. Yeah, it tastes good too.
Yeah, I haven't cut over to it yet. I'll still be using the Osmo until it's depleted. Then I'll probably start using Scratch.
Yep, there we are. So I guess that kind of covers planning coming in. Also, in this case, our course wasn't marked, so we had to have a GPS route. Make sure you have that if your course isn't marked. That's an important thing to do. So let's get into, first of all, when you're actually pre-riding, a few things. We already talked about taking your time, sessioning things, scouting lines, all important things. Also, take note of distance. You can also, if you have a Garmin, you can, or whatever head unit you have, you can lap.
Have we yet explained what sessioning is?
I don't know if we have. We've probably taken it for granted.
We've talked about it a few times, but Jonathan, why don't you explain it again?
Yeah, so the concept is with practice, you know, brings something closer to perfection. And in mountain biking especially, you basically have a puzzle every time you come across something technical. But the same could be said for a corner in a road course or anything else. You have multiple different lines that you can take. So when you go and session something, you basically try to find the best line. So that involves experimentation. Get out of your comfort zone maybe, or just try to find what you feel is the best. best. Once you find that, it's a good idea to repeat that a few times. Build in, there are a lot of different things that people talk about with building neural pathways with that, even with repeating it three times, muscular recruitment patterns, whatever else you want to talk about, you know, in terms of wiring yourself to take that line the next time. It's a really good idea to hit it multiple times. But something that is very key with this is if you're pre-writing this long before the race and it changes somehow, that is, you know, don't get too affixed to something so that you lose your mind on race day if it's slightly changed. So that, I guess that, does that describe sessioning well?
You did a great job.
Well, thank you, Nate. Thank you very much. We also, race day conditions, we rode it and it was cool. It was really nice. But the whole time we were constantly thinking of, this is going to be rough when it's hot.
So one thing, we're right on the side of a mountain in the evening and the sun had already set like over the mountain. So we had a lot of shade. And one of my friends who was riding, Casey, said, this is going to be pure sun all day long. And I was like, oh, you're right. We're going to be blazing.
Yep. It's going to be really hot. Also, when you're out on the course, this allows you to plan your feed strategy, whether you have feed zones or not. It's like, for example, we looked at this and we thought, and I even talking to Payson McKelvin, the national champ, I was like, that road section, because this course, you start out and you're on dirt for a long time, and then you have 2 miles of road, well, actually more like 3 miles of road, 2 miles coming into the finish, then 1 mile after the finish as you go out on the next lap. And I said, that's your spot to eat. And he said, yep, 100%. So once you ride the course, you can find where that is. And on mountain biking especially, that's really tricky because trying to choke down a gel or something like that when you're in a technical section is not okay.
Yep. And so in this one, like you just said, part of the race, the first part of the race is going to be easy, but you're probably not going to want to choke down a bunch of food at the very beginning. Yep. And then if you're going screaming downhill, you can't eat.
Right.
But on the road part, you can. And on the second one, if it's a steep climb, that's actually a steep climb that's not technical, you can eat then.
Yeah.
And that's in triathlon too, the same thing. It's a lot of times you, as a triathlete, you have to be able to eat kind of in the aero bars or you get out of them. But the best time would be a climb that you're not above FTP, that you're at maybe 80% or something, and you can get food out because you're sitting up already, so you don't get the arrow hit of eating. Mm-hmm. And then you just eat right then, and as long as you're not going too hard, because whenever you eat, you gotta breathe through your nose.
Yeah.
And it just makes it a little bit, at least for me, it makes it harder.
Totally.
Right?
Yeah, and also your body, I don't know if this is I assume there's something behind this, but also, I mean, if you're working really hard for a good amount of time, it's going to be harder for your body to digest that too.
Oh yeah, no, that's science.
So you need to give it. You need to give it some type of a break, right?
That's real.
So let's talk about the feed side of things, and let's kind of go backwards really quick and talk about how we prep for this event. I guess in terms of right now, we mentioned, Nate, that you were choking down some macaroni before the podcast.
Yep, double dose.
Yeah, double dose. He did.
They were mini ones, like for a kid.
So normal size.
Nate's like a kid,
but
I'm a big kid.
But this type of race especially, I think that it's we're looking at 4 to 5 hours of hard work. When we're descending, remember, this isn't like descending on a road bike. It's basically just like you're in the gym doing CrossFit. You're
plenty
squatting,
of work, yeah.
You're doing a huge amount of work, right? Mm-hmm. So this is a really like big, big toll. This is going to take a big toll on our bodies. Nate, how are you're the one that's really kind of driving this or testing out this more, like counting your calories and everything, counting the macros and everything else. What's your strategy or what are you testing out?
So just before this podcast, I wanted to read more about glycogen loading, and I did some internet research, but I did find a couple of interesting things. So basically, someone eating a normal diet of 45% carbohydrate, and I'm at 50%, they, on general, this is for like a trained athlete, has about 55 grams of carbohydrate in their liver and 280 grams in their muscles. That's just like a normal person. So that's kind of like a baseline. But what you can do is you can increase those levels through different types of loading.
Might this be called carb loading?
That is exactly right, Jonathan.
I'm quick.
So pretty much if this is for a person of the same weight, so at those levels of 55 and 280, you can get up to 160 in your liver and 720 in your muscle. So instead of a total of 330, a total of 880 grams. The caveat with that is that when every gram of glycogen in your muscles
packs on water.
Exactly, 2.1 grams of water. So if you go up to that, the maximum amount, this athlete could have about 2 more kilograms of water weight on race day.
Which isn't necessarily the worst thing when hydration is a concern, which, you know, when isn't it?
It's not like you're just carrying around fat or useless weight. Mm-hmm. We're talking about there's water there. So it's useful.
It's fuel and hydration and water. And as you use that fuel, the water gets released and you'll actually be able to drink less. So in our race, it's tough because it's a big climb, and 4 extra pounds on a big climb is going to be noticeable. But if it's super hot, let's say we're going to do a Ironman, and we're going to swim at first, weight does not matter at all. Hydration would be awesome because you can't drink. And then a lot of Ironman bike courses, they're not, it's more about aero, you know?
Yep.
So having a little bit extra weight is not going to be a big deal. You're on your TT bike. You're going to also get the benefits of the glycogen. And then by the time you get to the run where the weight really does matter, you're probably through all that extra water weight.
Yeah.
Yep. And you're replenishing anyways, right? So you're kind of, you're trying to keep up. So in that case, it'd be good if we're doing a hour race, like a cross race, you don't need all that glycogen. So this is like maximum amount. And if you're doing 2, 3, 4 hours, not even 2, 4 hours, we probably will go through this.
Yep.
Especially if it's a hard effort. But a cross race, no, there's no reason, right?
There's no reason to.
Yeah.
And that's something that goes with, like, even if you're doing like a criterium, or if you're doing anything that isn't too long, sometimes those criteriums last for a long time. But if you're doing even like shorter road races, like if you're doing like Cat 5 stuff and you guys are limited to 40 mile road races, 40 miles of race pace goes by really quick.
Real quick.
So you don't necessarily need to load up, and I should say more specifically, by loading up, you may actually be doing yourself more of a disservice.
That's the key takeaway, right? Because in that road race where maybe it all breaks up on the climb, you add an extra 4 pounds to your body because you're like, I need all these carbs.
Yeah.
And you don't need the water. There's just no point.
Yeah, just keep the energy requirements of your event in mind.
Yep. That's the smart way to do it. Also,
and it's worth saying, or it's worth mentioning, that endurance training does influence both your glycogen synthesis rates and storage capacity.
Exactly. So, and what I've read about is that a normal person, a well-trained athlete, can store much more glycogen in both their liver and their muscles than just a person sitting on the couch. So I think too, this is the reason why Chad needs less food than me. The size of his muscles too, his legs are they're much bigger than mine, right?
Yes, they are. covered this before.
But they are. Aero legs, and manly cycling legs.
The cross section. More muscle mass, more storage capacity.
Exactly, so when he doesn't have to eat as much for these races, it makes sense because he's storing more.
More on board.
Exactly. He's more on board. Uh-huh. Another thing that I think I will carb load for is single track 6 because I don't need it for the first day's race, but 6 days of racing.
No, stage racing and carb loading kind of makes
sense. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Again,
The first race is like a hill climb at the very beginning and it's going to break it up, you might not want to do it. But this is 6 days where it's just all
time-based.
It's
more or less the same.
Yeah, it's like attrition for me, at least. It's going to be attrition. So
I think they're short enough events, so I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I'm glad that you're doing it, that one of us is doing it, because I'd like to see how we stack up.
You're going to see me eat so many carbs each day.
Gross.
But I mean, that's an important thing when you compare, because people might be like, Chad doesn't eat food, so I don't need to.
Yeah.
But he does have more. I mean, I wish we could measure. Well, we should try to see if we can measure the amount of glycogen that you can hold versus I can hold.
Yeah. Yeah, that's worth investigating.
That'd be really interesting, right?
Sure.
Because we're the same body weight, different heights, but you have much more muscle mass in your legs and pretty much everywhere.
Yeah. Also, within this too, we talked about those max numbers. Something that we should cover is the fact that as long as you can really eat that much and hold
you
that down
to
and be able to stomach it.
Because would you say how many grams?
Well, let's talk about the different ways, okay?
Okay.
So an old kind of way they talked about is glycogen stripping. 6 days before the event, you strip it all. So you try to like deplete your glycogen stores. Then you do 3 days of protein and fat, and you just try to get no glycogen at all in your muscles.
Yeah.
And then you do 3 days of high carbs, and that can lead to a glycogen load. And the idea is you're stripping so much, there's like your body will super compensate and bring it up.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, they found that eating about 75% of your calories from carbs 3 days before the event, same results. So you don't have to do that, go through all that.
Yeah, the stripping's been kind of debunked.
Yep. And now there's a new way that there's also been studies on where a short workout carb loading. So they would do like, what is it? 150-second intervals at 130% of your VO2 max,
so
followed by 30 seconds of all-out cycling.
Yeah.
So it's really, and 130% of VO2 max is like, what, like 170 FTP or something?
Yeah, about that.
So pretty much all out efforts, very anaerobic.
Yeah.
And then after that, for the 24 hours, they would ingest 10.3 grams of carbs per kilogram of body weight.
That is a lot.
That is a lot of high glycemic carbs.
Ton.
So at my weight, 84 kilograms, and I'm 184, 185 pounds, that's 865 grams of carbs.
I would never be able to eat
times that much. Four.
It's about 30.
No, that's just for one day.
For grams. Yeah, but I'm just talking about calories.
Calories, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's a lot of
times
calories.
Times four. It's a hell of a lot.
You're getting close to what, 3,500 calories?
Yeah,
just
in that ballpark.
Carbohydrate.
Yep. So bodybuilders do this to actually look more full on stage. They will eat like this much of just something like a potato right before an event, and it actually fills them up and they look bigger because there's more glycogen in their muscles.
Is that because they're storing more water?
No, it's actually glycogen and they feel more full. It's a very, very common thing to do pre-show.
Yeah. Interesting.
Anyway, so out of those, and again, they also mentioned if you can't absorb those carbs, if you're not an Olympic eater like me, like you two guys, wouldn't be able to handle it.
Yeah, I would not be able to handle it. And I take a much more, so I just mentioned that I've only had eggs this morning. I had two eggs and that's it. I definitely am not following along that, and not out of intention, but that's just the way the day's shaken down, right? So I will be, and I usually have, you know, I eat rice the day before, or a couple days before a race, that type of a thing. And I might increase the amount that I eat by a certain amount, but I certainly don't go crazy and also don't measure it. So it's hard for me to actually say exactly what I do, but I do increase the amount that I eat usually before a race like this, a big one, before Lost and Found I did. And before this, I will.
It's also important of what type of carbohydrate, because I was thinking 800 calories. I'm like, oh, I'll just drink a lot of juice because that's easy. But actually, you don't want to use
fructose. Yeah.
Yep. Fructose, and we were just looking. I want to say that fructose does not do as good of a job. Some sites say fructose can't get into the muscles at all for glycogen. But let's just say, I want to be accurate here, that it does not do as good a job. So you want to avoid carb loading with fructose.
Yeah, because, and let's just to clarify, we've seen from reputable sources both sides of that, right? That it can't, and then it also that it can.
Yeah, well, up until this point, it was understood by us that fructose was simply processed by the liver, converted to glucose, and then that glucose could be, you know, basically shuttled to the muscles for usage. But then it came across just one bit of advice that just threw a wrench in those works.
So that's what happens while you're working out too. That's why you eat something like scratch is cane sugar.
Yep.
And that will go to your muscles while you're working out, but we're talking about loading, right? Like ahead of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So things with fructose, fruit juices, some vegetables, honey. If you read a package, here are the things that might be another name for fructose. All fructose, high fructose corn syrup, which is also HFCS, you'll see. That's in a lot of stuff.
Mm. A lot.
Honey, agave syrup, invert sugar, maple flavored syrup, molasses, palm or coconut sugar.
Basically plant sugar.
Yeah. So to clarify, would maple fall within that? You said maple flavored, but I...
Maple flavored syrup. I'm guessing, I don't know if that means maple syrup. I don't know if maple syrup is fructose or not.
You
know,
interesting.
I do not.
We should look.
I'll look into that.
If you like to have maple syrup the day before to load, you should look it up and see if that's... John's going to write
it down. I'm sure it's a high glycemic food. It's got to be. I just don't know.
So what you can use, starch like a pasta... Bread, rice, and potatoes. And I remember, I don't have it here, but before I did Israman, I read something that's saying that rice actually loaded better than bread for the amount of calories you ate.
Hmm.
So that's all I have to do. Right now we're cooking a bunch of brown rice.
Cool.
And we actually do, side note, GABA brown rice. So that's brown rice that's been sprouted.
Sprouted rice.
And GABA is like a type of amino acid. So our rice cooker has a setting that helps sprout it before it cooks it. And you just pretty much get more amino acids for the same nutritional, like the same amount of rice. You get higher nutritional content, which is kind of cool.
Very cool. So with that part covered, I'm going to jump back. Sorry for the asynchronous.
What are you going to do nutritionally?
Oh, in terms of nutrition?
Yeah.
This, in terms of on the bike, I'm going to have Scratch Labs stuff in my bottles. We already covered that part. But then in terms of what I'm going to be eating on the bike, we were just talking about, I've been testing out Justin's.
Well, first, what night prior?
Oh, night prior. I am probably going to have what I usually have. I make some stir fry and some fried rice at home, and it's pretty light stuff. Like it's just the rice, and I have some soy sauce, some brown sugar, and some ginger in there. And it's, but it's not a lot of it.
We're missing a key point here for John's nutrition is that he's going to do the fat tire crit the night before.
Yeah.
A highly glycogen dependent race.
Yes.
The night before.
20 minutes plus three laps. So pretty much
about
all
25.
Out.
Yeah. Just a little over 25 minutes.
So after that, you're going to have, it's like a high glycogen race before a high glycogen race.
Yeah. And it's
you're having two eggs this morning for breakfast.
It's a thin 12 hours too, which is tricky on the sleep part. That's really my main concern. But tonight we're going to be having that stir fry, and it's just, but it's like a very basic stir fry. I don't want to go through the ingredients list, but very basic stuff. That's usually what I have the night before. And then morning of, here's the tricky part. The sleep is going to be tough for me because
so hard.
I race. So I got a great night's sleep last night, like we talked about last time. I'm going to be all wound up after 25 minutes. Although I should clarify, because I was invited to race this pro crit by Epic Rides. Thank you very much for doing that. I'm invited as media. So as a result, I was told that I should race as media and not for the win. So I'm sure Howard Grotz is very excited because he now knows that I'm not going to be racing for the win.
Dude, if Lance is in there, I just want you to, it's just cool to, not anything about Lance's history, but it's just cool to say you could beat Lance.
Yeah, well, but he won't be in the...
He won't be in the crit?
No, he won't be in the crit. Okay. No, this is just the crit. Tomorrow, it's game on, but for just the crit. But just the same, I'm going to be in the mix the whole time. It's going to be really tough. It's going to be hard to sleep right after that. And then I have to get up early enough in the morning. I've found that 2.5 hours before I race is when I need to eat. And when I'm waking up, so my race starts at 7:15, we have to meet at our office about a half hour before that. So that means that I need to be eating everything at 5 a.m. I need to be done with my breakfast by 5:15.
You have a little kid. You get up at 5 a.m. probably every day.
Yeah, pretty much. So
this is another thing that I read while researching this is that actual eating carbohydrate between like 2 hours before an aerobic event can actually decrease your performance in some people. And they call it like transient hypoglycemia.
It's a hypoglycemic slump, yeah.
Yeah, we talked about it. It's like Michael Scott on Pretzel Day from The Office, if you've ever seen that, The American Office, when he just completely crashes.
Yeah, it's a big bump
crazy.
In blood sugar and then a big low, a big crash. Yeah.
I've had this, so I experience this the most when I try to eat on the weekend I'll do like something hypoglycemic like pancakes and maple syrup.
Yeah.
And then I'll wait like an hour and then I'll try to do a workout right after that.
And you'll feel worse.
Horrible. Yeah. Like I just feel like there's nothing in my body.
Yeah, blood sugar swings aren't fun.
Yep. And the other thing I've been doing in the past is I will sip carbohydrate beverage like down on the race. Mm-hmm. I'm going to stop all that. I'm going to do I think about 3 hours is what I like to do. So I'll do like my oatmeal 3 hours before. That should give enough time to digest. Mm-hmm. And then I'll do like, I like chews like right before, like almost on, like you're lining up to do it. Mm-hmm. And I'll do it right then. And then I'll go ride.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's kind of my plan. And then throughout the ride, I'm going to be using, I'm going to try to use that almond butter, Justin's almond butter, and they've got a vanilla one that's just delicious.
So Chad, can you explain that? Because
honestly, I can't get behind that. I think that's going to sit in your gut. It's hard to metabolize fat, period. It's certainly hard to do it under working conditions.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I
hasn't messed up my stomach yet.
And that's why I didn't advise against it. It wouldn't work for me. It hasn't worked for me.
Well,
there's
not messing up your stomach and then increasing your performance. So it might not mess up your stomach.
And it's going to come down to intensity level too. And you're
he goes
got a
hard.
Hard day ahead of you.
Yeah. Really hard.
That's why I'm a little kind of curious to see how this plays out.
Yeah, so what would you recommend then as an alternative?
Just what we're doing. I mean, the pro bars. I mean, if you're eager to have some fat in there and a bit of protein. Those pro bars have a really nice blend and they're palatable. I like them. They actually taste like food.
Yeah, they do.
And I think you can quarter them because they're so big in calories, like 380 for the peanut butter one. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you quarter that and have one of those every 30, 40 minutes, it's a pretty good intake.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going to do.
What would you recommend, Nate?
So I have a mix of my gels. Yeah. The chews are pure sugar.
Okay.
And I like those a little bit earlier in the ride. And
which
then
one do you use?
The Honey Stinger Pink Lemonade, because they have a really, the texture, it's easy to eat.
Okay.
And then I have the Honey Stinger Waffles, which do have some fat, but also a lot of carbs.
Mm-hmm.
And those also taste amazing. Have you guys ever had those?
Yeah.
They're delicious. Like,
they're good.
I think, you know, it's a good bar if you can give it to your kids and they like and want them as candy.
Yeah. I liked those a lot until I didn't, which goes with every one of these little manufactured foods.
Yeah, that's how it goes,
right? And then after that, then I'll do the Pro Bar, which also has protein in it.
Yeah.
At like when they get longer into the race with a little bit more fat and that kind of mix with Gatorade the whole time. I like doing it in that progression. Whereas, because later as I get on too, I want the more savory kind of stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I'm
which
sick
is
of the sugar.
Which is kind of one of the motives in that almond butter, because it isn't fully sweet, right?
Yeah, no, it's very savory.
It has a bit of savory.
Something else we should talk about is there's research that just a carbohydrate wash in your mouth, like something really sweet, improves performance.
Yeah, let's expand on that in a podcast once I've done a little brushing up on that. But it's
you don't have to digest
it. It's factual.
Yeah.
There's no digestion taking place. It wakes up nerve receptors in your mouth. It's basically sending a message to your brain that food's coming, even though it's not.
Yeah, exactly.
Yikes. So that's the plan because it hasn't messed me up so far. Rice cakes is not going to be really an option. And the reason that I say that is because the pace is going to be really hard. And I don't know, number one, if the rice cakes will just crumble apart in my pockets because there'll be a lot of jostling going on. I don't think I'll have enough time to make them the proper way to actually make them work on race day. So it's going to be tricky. We'll see. Pro bars are something that I've used before with great success too. So I guess this is me just trying to think of all the jarring and everything else, something that would go down a little easier.
Yeah, I don't know when, besides on the road, when you would eat.
The only other spot where you could technically do it, I guess, is, and once again, we'll try to make this, externalize it from this event, but the only spot where you could technically do it is when you get onto some fire road, which isn't very long, but there is a section of fire road that you ride.
Having pre-ridden that, and you know, yet another benefit of the pre-ride, is I found several places on there where all you're doing is reaching into your pocket and popping a chunk in your mouth, and then just, you know, kind of squirreling it away, chewing on it when you can, breathing through your mouth as necessary.
Yeah,
it's not, there are a lot of places.
Are you guys, listening back to the last episode or two episodes ago, are you going to unwrap your food this time? Because Chad was like, yes. I don't want to waste it.
I typically do that. For that ride, I didn't expect to eat much food. This ride, I expect to eat. So I'm going to have one in each pocket, quartered in its wrapper, but the wrapper open.
Yeah.
Why in its wrapper?
Just because I don't want to get goo all over I don't want it to melt, basically. It's going to be a hot day all over my jersey.
Yeah, I'm not going to unpackage the almond butter. That would be bad. So I guess that kind of, does that cover it? Now, Chad, what are you going to do the night before, morning of, and I guess those two things?
Same thing.
He doesn't know where he's going to dinner tonight.
Fast and loose.
We have a company dinner.
I don't know that I'm going to eat it either. That will depend, but there's probably... Carbs. Nah, just what I always do, which is pizza and ice cream. I'll probably have pizza for breakfast tomorrow morning.
Chad, I'll tell you, we're having pizza tonight for dinner.
Seriously?
Yep.
Oh, fantastic.
Yep.
There we are.
It's a good pizza place too.
Nice. Awesome.
Oh, that works out.
One thing I want to touch on really quick, we're going back to executing your pre-ride. Analyzing your equipment choice and bike setup. You have a plan, clearly, hopefully, coming into this, that you're testing out. I, for example, I just got my suspension back before that pre-ride. It was getting rebuilt by a company called Squish Dynamics, which, by the way, if anybody has RockShox suspension, hot tip. They are really good at fixing stuff quickly.
Noted.
But I sent that back to them. I got it back, and I have to redo a lot of settings, and I learned that on that pre-ride. If I had gotten this shock and not ridden it on that course and just gone into things, I probably wouldn't have noticed it. But this course has... It's demanding in the sense that it's got really sharp, steep, kind of mantly rocky stuff in spots, but then it's also got really fast, flowy stuff that tests your suspension in a different manner. So if I had just ridden it on any given trail, who's to say that I would have tested it to those constraints or those lengths, I guess. So because of that, I was analyzing my setup and I thought, okay, I need to run more compression in my suspension and I need to change the rebound damping. And I was making mental notes while I was doing it. So analyzing that stuff while you're doing it is very key.
And a key note on this too is it's not like you've been holding off on doing this and it happened the week before.
Right.
Like you had a problem the week before.
Exactly.
Yep. And then you were able to ride with it.
Which kudos to them. I sent it to them.
Yeah, they turned it around quick.
He had it for one. I asked him how long it would take. I was expecting days. And he said, maybe 50 minutes. I was like, wow, okay.
Jeez.
That's great. And he just sent it back.
And with me, one thing that I noticed is on a downhill section that we had on the road, just on asphalt we're riding, I wasn't in the pack. I was kind of back, so I didn't have any aero benefit. Mm-hmm. But I could not keep up with the pack just drifting down the hill. No one was pedaling. And normally, on any road bike, I'm always having to hit my brakes because I'm heavier, mm-hmm. and I just fly by everybody.
What do you attribute that to? Tire choice?
Tire choice, yep. Mm-hmm. And I think I have, in the front, I have a Minion DHF, mm-hmm. which is a Maxxis tire.
Which is what I'm running.
Awesome, awesome tire for loose conditions, or really, it's an awesome tire for traction. Mm-hmm.
But that's what it's made for, traction. It's very heavy. It's like 1,000 grams. So I have now switched to the Minion SS, which I had in the back. I put that in the front too. So I'm doing a race, brand new, with a new front tire.
I'm not. I'm leaving everything exactly as it was. Well, I take that back. I did cut my bars down and I did drop my saddle a little bit, but I actually manufactured that saddle drop with my dropper post. So I rode it at the height I needed it. Now it's set at that height.
Perk of dropper post right there.
Absolutely. Saved my day.
But yeah. So the reason I changed the tire is I don't think I need as much front traction on this tire because I'm not pushing it through the corners or anything. Basically, when I get to a certain speed, I slow down because I just don't like the speed. I get scared of if something were to pop out, how long would it take me to stop?
It's just a product of time. That'll change.
Exactly, yeah. But even at like driving on the freeway, I don't like being close to the person in front of me because I'm like, if something happened and that car had to stop, I have no option but to be hurt.
And it's interesting because I somewhat disagree with Nate not on the freeway thing. That's yes. But on the tire selection, I somewhat disagree because...
You totally disagree.
Yeah. Well, you've been
pushing me to keep the DHF.
Yeah. And I think that you have a good tire choice set up now. I do think you do.
I wanted for a second to go to like really race tires.
Right. But I think that you would be even better in the other way because... The one thing is you're never looking at your Garmin going, oh boy, we're over 16 miles an hour. That's my cutoff point. I need to back it off. It's all perception and sensation of speed. And I think that when you have a bike that is glued to that ground and more confident or confidence inspiring, you are able to not necessarily carry more speed. You're just able to be more calm. On race day, you're able to be more comfortable. You're able to approach lines better.
That actually kind of ties back to one of the benefits of sessioning. If we hit those spots 5-6 times, you just get progressively more relaxed. It's a little less fear-inspiring each time.
The one thing that I've always kind of, and especially with tires, even from my motocross days, people would always be like, oh, you buy tires? I used to go through like a tire a week in the rear and then like a tire every 3 weeks in the front. And that's really expensive. Mm-hmm. But the reason that I did that was I always said, well, you know, a tire is a whole lot cheaper than replacing big parts of my bike or hospital bills. Mm-hmm. And when you come to racing a bike, it's the same in that respect in terms of cost. But when you're looking at a time cost, I always look at it and I think, well, on mountain biking, I can err on the side of really fast rolling resistance and have, you know, and sacrifice traction and risk a crash. And I guarantee you that if I crash, it'll probably be in a situation where I was carrying high speed and that's where it was sacrificed. And that's going to make me a whole lot slower.
And that's why I'm sticking with the beefier front tire.
Yeah.
I think though that talking to other riders here, that I have a feeling that my front tire is still going to be great traction.
It will.
So I don't have like, I'm not scared about that. And I was thinking last night too, it's so, you know, I have this fear of like not being in control and something in front of me happening that I can't respond to. Yeah. And literally over like 3 years, I had like 3 minutes where I put myself in that situation and the guy in front of me crashed and I broke my collarbone.
Right.
Like,
yeah, that's unfortunate.
It's somewhat of an irrational fear, but it's still there, right?
It's definitely rational, right? I got 9 screws to prove it, Jonathan.
Yeah. But at the same time, when you look at your experience.
For everybody else, yeah. I was very unlucky,
right.
But it backs up a perception that I have that it is unsafe to be in that situation.
Yeah.
And I get into it for 3, maybe 5 minutes, and it happens.
Yeah, it gets tough. And that actually kind of goes in line with one of the last things I want to cover, and this is something that you added in, Chad. Mm-hmm. And actually, I've written down on the screen, Nate, but don't get in your head on pre-ride day when you're riding the course. That's super important.
It's so easy to be negative. I caught myself doing it a number of times, like, oh, I'm so bad at this section. How am I going to handle this on race day? Or here's another section just like that. I didn't do any better this time. And it's this downward spiral. It does you no good whatsoever.
I think I'm actually good on this because I think on race day, I clear, even if I just pre-ride a lap on a small short track thing, mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, I'll make that during the race. And it's true. Like in cyclocross, there'll be something hard and I'll walk it and I just make it during the race. Mm-hmm. And the other thing with triathlons, even if you drive or do it, the hills always seem steeper when you pre-ride it.
Oh, yeah.
And then during the race, when you're all like race kitted out and you're glycogen loaded, but you're ready and you're in the race, they all seem easier and they're shorter and it's
until the last lap. Yeah, until the last lap. But I am going to point out, Nate, that you were particularly bad at this on our pre-ride in a few spots. We got down past like a short descent, but it was really steep. It was fast and it was loose. And then right at the base of that, we went up a climb that was, I guess it's not technical in terms of like ledges or anything else that you're getting up, but it was
deep and rutted and rocky
and loose.
Loose, you had loose to have is a better term.
Yeah, you had to have really good line choice. You basically had to look ahead, analyze things, and think, okay, I should go here, here, and here.
Kind of had to traverse the rut, which is a little tricky.
Mm-hmm. And everyone worked their way up, and then Nate, you were at the bottom. And I was waiting for you to saddle up and give this thing your best shot, and you didn't even try. And I went down to you, and you just said, "This course is terrible for me. I'm going to do so bad. This is terrible."
Well, that's true.
And you walked up the climb and just you were unloading on yourself. And that's something that is so easy, like Chad, you said, so easy to do.
Yeah, once you start, you got to make a real conscious effort to stop it.
Yeah, and I think that the best way for me to stop that is just basically look at what you can do instead of what you can't, because you may show up in a situation where the course is over your head, right? But just focus on what you can do and always try to focus on moving that part forward and just focus on that. The stuff you can't do, a lot of the time, like you said, Nate, you'll come up on race day and you'll be like, "Oh, I'll do it on race day." If that works for you, that's great. But also just tell yourself, "I'm not going to worry about that on race day."
Yeah, because as soon as you tell yourself you can't, you're right. I mean, that's just how it goes.
I'm just going to deal with that on race day. But right now I'm just going to focus on doing what I do well. And that's the cool part is on the pre-ride course, if you don't just go out there looking for what you can't do well, but you look at what you do really well, that's how you can change that into a really positive experience.
So my comments there were in response to trying to beat Chad, is that it's just not a course that Lost and Found would be more geared towards me, and that wasn't geared towards me, you know? And that downhill that I went on, that was the steepest downhill I've ever been on.
It was pretty steep.
I had to be well behind my dropped saddle post.
Yeah. Really?
Yep. Huh. And then I was very exhausted, and the three people ahead of me were already walking their bike up it, and Jonathan's calling down, "You can make it. I found the line." And there was so much room between us that I didn't know where the line was, but by the time he got down there, I couldn't get back on my bike because it's 15% grade.
Yeah, which once again, I guess, comes down to sessioning, right? We should have sessioned.
That totally would have been a good one.
Yep. We could have just went back to the bottom.
Those two sections, we could have spent our whole day doing that.
Yep.
Yeah, I think it would have been key.
Probably save 5 minutes on race day.
Yeah.
Probably.
Remember, pre-riding is supposed to put you in a better place, not only in terms of preparation, but also mentally for race day. That should be the goal with it. So after you do the pre-ride, you definitely want to go through and kind of do a post-mortem, so to speak, and really analyze what happened or compare it.
Record a podcast.
Yes, exactly. Just like what we're doing here. So for example, if you had a game plan, look at how that actually, and you were testing that, look at how it played out, whether that's with equipment or pacing or nutrition, anything else, if you were able to test those type of things, be honest with yourself and don't feel like you're stuck into anything too much. That said, you can also get to the point where if you have a negative experience and you get scared and everything else, you can just throw everything out the window, throw the baby out with the bathwater, and then you end up really putting yourself in a hole. So
there's one other part in this course that I'm glad we did finish it. It's part of, I didn't know this term before, it was bench cut.
Yes.
Which means it's an extremely steep side of a mountain, and it's cut in so steep that were to step off of it, you would roll down the hill 1,000 feet.
Yeah.
And there are some sections in there where you could be going. It's hard for me to even look at you, Jonathan, because I'm scared for you. But Jonathan might be going 25, 30, right?
Yeah.
On loose over hard.
Yeah.
And I, on those, I just, it's, the benefit is when I get to there, I'll know it's there, and I'm not going to take extra chances on that bench cut. Chad?
The downside is knowing that it's there and anticipating it the whole time and focusing on it, giving it far too much energy, which...
I didn't even think about it until... You're right, though. That could be.
It could be.
Yeah.
There are a couple spots that stick in my brain. One of them was a sharp switchback where if you miss it, you're off the cliff. I mean, it was deadly.
Well, and that's an important thing for especially mountain bikers, but also road riders. And even in certain situations with triathlon, too, you may go through a city center or you may do something where it is a sketchy spot. And pick those out, because we came across on that bench cut section. It's long. It's I think it's like 7 miles of single track. It's pretty long. And on that section, there were a few spots that I knew the trail very well. I've ridden that trail a lot. And this year, because of all the heavy rain and everything else we had, I hadn't ridden it yet. And having ridden it the first time I rode it this year, it caught me by surprise. There are a lot of spots that were very washed out. And if I had just charged like I had charged before without giving myself a situation to approach it outside of a race, that could have been pretty bad. So certainly adjust that game plan once again.
The other example that I'm really glad we did it for, but it's not for fear, is there is one line down in this valley where there's two ways, a left and a right. The right way looks like the hard way, and you're like, oh, I'm going on the left. But then all of a sudden there's like a 5 foot drop on the left. So I hope the race day they like rope it off.
We'll see what they do.
People can get hurt.
I'm sure they'll probably indicate something there.
Like,
but
yeah, everyone go right.
Something. Yeah. Or they'll, I'm sure they'll leave it open, but just indicate that that's like a dangerous line.
So. I guess if you are fast, that would be the faster line, right? Just to fly off the
edge. In that situation, it's actually not, because it's you land flat slash uphill. Mm. So as a result, you lose momentum. Whereas to the right, you can carry it. Because that with any line that you're looking at, whether it's on a road bike or a mountain bike, you should always look at the momentum potential behind this.
How much speed can you carry?
Exactly.
The other benefit of this is, I think this race has 30 switchbacks per lap or something.
Oh, probably more.
So
lots of work on our switchbacks, uphill and down.
I got to work on them, and I actually could take a lot of the switchbacks.
Nice.
There's some at the end that I know I'll unclip 1 foot, but if you know ahead of time, you just unclip, and I can go. I was going through as fast as the guy ahead of me who wasn't unclipping.
Yep.
If you just know, if you know ahead of time. But other ones too, I know like, oh, I can make this.
Unclipping as in dangling your foot or planting it and pivoting?
I dangle my foot and kind of, if I do take it too sharp, my foot hits the ground if it slips out.
So fail safe, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and it helps my balance, you know.
Yeah. So I guess that kind of covers things. Although Chad, you put something in here about managing weaknesses and exploiting strengths and everything else.
Another benefit of the pre-ride. There are going to be sections on it that are going to challenge you. You might not be exceptionally good at that. That's okay. But there will be sections where you can kind of make up for it, at least both in terms of performance, but also psychologically. Get yourself back on track and recognize I am good at some of this stuff.
I didn't realize too that the asphalt section would be so long.
It's funny because on the map, it doesn't show as being very long, like in terms of distance, but that it feels long, doesn't it?
So it
It'll be a nice break from the challenge of the rest of the course.
But I know that if I see anyone, I'm going to try to sprint to get on their wheel.
Yes.
And then just draft. Because it's good. You go 20 the whole time back, right? Mm-hmm. And you want to be in the draft, and it's a technical
climb
after that.
It's a fairly long stretch, yeah.
And I also know that I don't want to put out a lot of power on the asphalt section because I'm going to be overcoming aerodynamic drag. Unless I'm trying to jump on someone's wheel, because after that, I have a long technical climb, and technical climbs also take more power to get through stuff. And if I'm tired, then
strength and energy,
I'm going to stop more. And while you're climbing, you're going to the power output should be while you're climbing, because you're going to get a better benefit because you're not having aerodynamic drag slowing you down.
Correct. Yep. Absolutely. So I'm really excited for this race, and I'm super glad that Epic Rides is around to kind of save XC racing with these type of races. It's good to have them, and it's pretty cool to have one so close.
Pretty amazing course, got to say.
Yeah, hopefully what you all could glean from this are principles that you can apply to whatever race you are doing, and how to pre-ride if you need to pre-ride, and how to learn from the whole experience and manage it well. And hopefully I'll beat Nate to the finish line tomorrow. Fingers crossed.
I hope you do, because that means you did really well. I hope I do well and you beat me. That's what I hope.
You take the fun out of it there, Nate. You should have said you really hope you don't, and then it would have been really fun for everyone listening. But that's okay.
Okay.
All right, everybody. We will talk to you next week. We'll have a post-mortem on this race, and we'll get to go through it, and we'll get to see, and we'll go through how we actually learn from a race in retrospect and how we'd adjust from there as well.
And hopefully how Jonathan beat Lance.
Oh yeah, hopefully. Yeah. That's the race to go.
That's the race.
Right, that's it. All right, everybody. Thanks so much. Take care.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.